Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:45 in that specific summer time. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And first, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. And we've had pretty strong rallies. This has been what we saw last week was that the majority of markets found support either above or in the region of their late August lows. And then this week we've had really quite a substantial rally to take a number of indices back up to the upper side, or where the first area of resistance had been. The S&P is a prime example of that, but it cleared the 2000 level yesterday, and the DAX is clearing the 10,000 level in here today. The IBEX in Spain is clearing the 10,000 level. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong has found support in the region of 20,000, and it's about 10% off that low in here today. And this is really quite comforting from the perspective of someone who would have hung on throughout the pullback. Now, the pullback on Wall Street was approximately 14% from the May peak to the August 24th low. And that's in excess of the 10% pullback that we've been looking for. Then there is a raging debate going on. Obviously, sentiment tends to be really quite bearish at the bottoms, and sentiment has improved, you know, pretty substantially. But what we've really seen is that there's been a quite considerable rotation here in terms of the leadership within the market. Certainly, you look at a company like Nike, which in by any definition one might choose is just a leading company within its sector. It's just emblematic of the autonomies, and so far ahead in its individual sector that it would take some catching. But nonetheless, it has rallied approximately 25% from its late August low, and it's more overextended relative to the trend mean now than it was before the pullback. So then the question you have to ask is, where's the next 25% going to come from? If it rallies an additional 25%, well, then it will clearly be accelerating higher. And as we know from the chart seminar, acceleration is a trend ending. And then contrast that with some of the bounces that we are seeing in some of the sectors that were the most oversold. And among those in particular is the energy sector. Considering that until, and even still, I would say that there is a significant portion of people that look on the energy sector and say that this is something that is, we don't even need it anymore. That that coal is no longer going to be used, and certainly that might be the case in a number of developed markets, but that's certainly not the case in emerging markets. Then that the energy companies, like the oil companies, have over-invested and got themselves into all kinds of trouble in a low-energy environment. And certainly that is true for some of the most over-leveraged explorers and producers. But is that necessarily true for the large, highly diversified companies, and not least those that where they produce a majority of what they produce is natural gas? That's certainly the case for both Royal Dutch Shell and ExxonMobil. Well, oil prices have rallied, and they're back above $50. That's a 20% rally, and yet it's only $10 in terms of a price that has had a significant decline over the last year. And when one contrasts that with the steepening of the trend in something like Nike, then one has to start to think about the risk and reward. I'm a massive fan of Nike, but then there is a time to buy it, which is when it is pulled back to the mean. And when something has shot up and is developing an increasingly overextended position relative to the trend mean, then that's not necessarily the time when one should be thinking about buying more. But when you flip it around and you see something that is 30-40% below its 200-day moving average and begins to find support, well, then what's your risk? Your risk is that it goes back and tests the low. But the upside potential, just in terms of mean reversion alone, means that the potential for really impressive bounces becomes something that one has to consider. And from the perspective of a medium to long-term investor, then acquiring attractive assets at favorable prices is really what it's all about. That a trend-running tactic is so much easier to follow when you've picked it up at an attractive price, because then you can buy on weakness subsequently and not feel under any great pressure. And you have the opportunity to keep your average cost of purchase at a reasonable level, rather than buying something that, because it has been trending higher for such a long time and has been the relative outperformer in the very short term, that will continue to be the case is very questionable. Now, the commodity complex is very interesting at this level, because really it had reached pariah status, that there is a very large question, and it's probably not the question that that many people are really thinking about, and that is how much of the bad news that we continue to see in the media is already in the price. And there is a lot of bad news, but then we've already gone through a corrective phase, and certainly the corrective phase on Wall Street was shallower than we saw in a range of other markets, and not least because of the relative strength of the dollar and its safe haven status. Well, the dollar, and this is also something that it's sort of in assessing what I said and what I heard said at the Contrary Opinion Forum last week, perhaps the most the view that was given most often was that the dollar was now in a secular bull market, and that we could anticipate that the dollar was going to get progressively stronger from here. And I guess what started to worry me was that I wasn't particularly alien to that view, because I've been thinking that for quite some time. But that doesn't mean that the dollar can't go lower first. And that does look like what we're seeing here, that the Fed has no interest in seeing a progressively stronger dollar, particularly when they really do want to raise rates. They would much prefer to do that against the background of a weaker dollar. That would make their job a lot easier. And we have to consider that every currency is a ratio, and within any ratio there are two sides to the coin. So the euro is up almost a full cent in here today, and it's at 113.60. And well, if you look at the euro over the short term, well then what you're presented with is really incredibly volatile whipsaw action. But if you look at it over the last 5 years, or perhaps even longer than that, what you're presented with is base formation characteristics and a progression of higher reaction lows from the low that was posted earlier this year. Well, $1.15 is the upper side of that range, and it's now, as of today, looking like we're going to go back and see it retest that level. The potential for dollar preeminence is still, I think, a medium to long term consideration, but short term, and perhaps looking out to 2 to 3 months, then the dollar can get weaker, and then we could potentially see the euro get a bit stronger. But that's not really the most important. It's certainly the most looked at currency pair. But when you look at what the kind of carnage that has already taken place in emerging market currencies, and particularly the commodity producers. Now, certainly there are people that are looking at emerging market currencies, and if you think about Mark Mobius and his ilk, what they're looking at is the currencies of places like Indonesia and Malaysia, because those are the countries that have got the developing middle classes. Well, Malaysia is already a middle-income country, but it is in the developing middle-class sector nonetheless. Rather, they don't tend to be focusing on the commodity complex, and not least because, For example, the Brazilian real has gone from 150 to 4 to the US dollar in the last 3 years. And that represents really quite an incredible acceleration. And I don't think that the markets have any love for Dilma Rousseff, but that has already priced in just an incredible amount of bad news. So all you have to do is to see that things are not quite as bad as has already been priced in, and you're going to get at least a reversionary rally, and that is exactly what we're getting right now. We've had a substantial bounce in a number of currencies outside the G7, and we're seeing rather impressive bounces in a number of commodity-based currencies, not least the Aussie dollar or the loonie. That's right, the Canadian dollar. That also filters through to the real and to the South African rand. And there's a number of those Asian currencies are also looking like that they're going to bounce in here. And this is from quite depressed levels. Now, we can think about the bad news that got them to this level, which is already in the price. But the other way to think about it is in terms of the dividend that they're now receiving in terms of improved competitiveness. That if you're an exporter in Brazil and we're finding your business declining when the real was at 150 to the dollar, well, your life is a lot easier at 4 to the dollar. Well, obviously, the inflation rate is around 10%, and controlling that is certainly something that has to be taken into account. But the falling oil price, certainly not great for the exporting countries, but for a consumer of oil, even within those countries, this has been just an incredible benefit. And the fact now that prices are low, that they've gone up by 20%, isn't really going to affect the bottom line of the consumer, but it has a meaningful effect on the bottom line of the producer. That there's a great deal of additional supply becomes economic around $60. But the range from 40 to 60 is 50% from bottom to top. And, you know, we're only about halfway through that. So even though that there's a short-term overbought condition, there is the potential here that oil prices range. And I continue to think that oil has a comparison market in what happened with natural gas. And there's a reasonable way of thinking about that. It was that the shale revolution started off in the natural gas market. And it wasn't for a few years, but someone figured out how to apply it to oil wells as well. Well, the effect that shale gas had on the natural gas market was profound. And in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, prices went from over $10 to $150, and currently are around $250. And this range has been in the order of over 100%, from about $2 to $4, and occasionally a little bit lower and occasionally a little bit higher, but around between $2 to $4. Well, there's every possibility that oil prices could range in a similar fashion, that it's unlikely we're going to see prices go below 40 because a great deal of supply becomes uneconomic at $40. So that's then thinking that the US onshore supply cycle is the swing producer, and these shale gas and shale oil wells will be brought back online when prices get up towards $60, and drilling will trail off when prices get down towards 40. Refracking isn't something that anyone is really talking about yet, but what it means is that they can go back to old wells and they can refrack them for a fraction of the cost of the original drilling and reinvigorate the supply out of old wells. Now, the data is quite spotty. So, and geologists are cautious people. They're not going to make very big claims until they have data. But this has the potential to enhance the profitability of these wells. And it means that with care and attention and looking after the long-term health of the reservoir, that this isn't something that's about to go away. and there is meaningful potential for the cost of producing oil to contract. Well, I've often seen reports that every $10 move in oil represents a 0.1%, I think it's more than that, I think it's 0.2% of a cut to GDP. And it works exactly the same way the other way around, but with a lag. The consumer is benefiting enormously, and the USA having gone from declining output to increasing output, there are certainly mixed results. But for other countries, and particularly places like Japan and India, this is just an incredible boon. Well, what we've seen from emerging market currencies is that there was a great deal of leverage in the types of countries that haven't really got control of inflation or haven't been or were a little bit over leveraged to the commodity cycle. And India has stood out because it's an enormous beneficiary from lower oil prices. It has the dividend of having a very capable prime minister and a very capable central banker at the same time. And what is particularly interesting is that there couldn't have been any large leverage positions in the Indian rupee because it did not accelerate lower. But it has rallied, and that's really very positive for the Indian market. That doesn't mean the Indian market is going to perform as well as some of those that were deeply oversold. How could it when these short covering rallies can be so powerful, and then you have the log scale in your favor? It's a lot easier to rally by 10% when the price is 1 than when the price is 100. Well, that means then that India is unlikely to fall to new lows, and that despite the fact that it is currently trading below the 200-day moving average, that this is probably nothing more than a consolidation prior to the market moving higher from here. The emerging markets are still prone to the really quite large amount of outstanding debt that they have denominated in US dollars, and that's about $3 trillion. It is worth thinking about the bond markets because, we've long expressed a great deal of ambivalence towards bonds, and not least because the yield is so unattractive, and when you can get 2.6, 2.7 on the S&P even today, and percent that is, and 2.1 on a 10-year treasury, well, why wouldn't you own stocks? That's one of the reasons that the market has been able to hold up, that we're still in a liquidity-rich environment. The Fed might not be printing money, but they're certainly not withdrawing it. There's no great need for refinancing in 2015, and it's about $200 billion. Next year, which in the context of a market which numbers in the trillions, that refinancing requirement is very low. But what we can anticipate is that the ability of governments to fund themselves and corporations to fund themselves at record low rates is very quickly ending. What we've already seen is that high yield has yields have pushed out. But they're only at about 6%, and that's for double B. Well, considering that yields are 400 basis points on a double B spread is really not overly taxing. But and I think that they've probably gone a bit far in the very short term. So there is potential here that we see some contraction in the yield, but it's unlikely to get back to where we were previously. And that means that companies are not going to be able to borrow at record low rates. Well, if they aren't able to borrow at record low rates, then how much of the money that they're raising is going to go back into buybacks or raising dividends? Any company that is anybody in the corporate treasury with any brains will have already refinanced most of their old debt into lower rates, and that's wonderful for them that their ongoing funding requirements are probably going to rise, but their historic debt is at very favorable rates. And then the really big question is, what's going to happen when they have to refinance that debt? Well, more than likely they're going to have to pay more for it. And but that's, generally speaking, when one looks at the bond markets, particularly in the USA, the big time when a lot of that debt has to be refinanced is about 3 to 4 years from now. So the issue in bond markets could be slow burn for a while before becoming rather intense when some of these companies have to refinance. And that's not going to be a problem for companies like Apple or Google, where their issuance of debt has more to do with avoiding taxes on their foreign cash piles. But rather, it's going to be more of an issue for the high yield sector. There's been an incredible amount of commentary circulating on whether there's going to be a recession next year. And we don't really have a great deal of evidence for that. And one could really consider that that is symptomatic of the fact that we've just gone through a 14% pullback on the stock market, and that people naturally start to think about a recession. You know, there's the old definition of a recession is that a recession is when your friend loses his job, and a depression is when you lose yours. But personally, I don't know anybody who's lost their job. Certainly, the people in Standard Chartered aren't going to be particularly happy with 1,000 people being fired, but that's within a very troubled corporation, and the number of corporations that are that troubled is relatively small outside of the commodity sector. And a lot of the tough decisions have all, and I would consider that Standard Chartered is in the commodity sector considering how much money they lent to commodity companies. When you look around the place, that a lot of the layoffs have already taken place in energy. And with prices stabilizing, then that raises the possibility that the pace of rationalization could moderate. It doesn't mean that we're going to see energy prices surging back to $100, I think far from it. But we are at pretty depressed levels. Now, there is an additional consideration here, and that is that the stock market has been rallying since 2009. And against that background, one has to consider that we are already 6 years into a very impressive bull market. There isn't anything yet to say that we're not still in a ranging phase. The S&P 500 is currently around 2007, and there are three potential areas of resistance. There's around the 2000 level, which is a psychological roundophobia level. There's the regional moving average, which it's just about testing now. And there's the lower side of the overhead range. And any one of those could be a potential area of resistance. And it suggests that as we clear each one, then confidence will improve. But it might take time. And that thinking that we're just going to rally all the way back up to the high and break out, I think is probably a bit too enthusiastic, that we're in for more of a ranging environment, and that there is a short-term overbought condition following what has been a really very impressive rally this week. So now there is potential for consolidation, and provided that consolidation is relatively shallow and occurs above the low from last week, well then I think a lot of people will find that confidence improving even further. The rising interest rates that could potentially happen in December or potentially in the first quarter of next year are a potential hurdle. But when we think about this long term, that the rise of the global middle class is a virtual certainty, because governance really is improving. And certainly the commodity complex and the bull market in commodities for most of the last decade papered over a lot of cracks in a lot of countries, and not least in the Middle East and Latin America. Well, with falling commodity prices, the holes that they have in their governance have become really quite apparent. But when you look elsewhere, that you have a reform-minded prime minister now in somewhere like Nigeria, that Ethiopia is an increasingly vibrant democracy, that Ghana has the best record of peaceful transfers of power in Africa, that India has that the democracy took the initiative and elected a reform-minded prime minister. That in Indonesia, Mr. Widodo has been dealt a very difficult hand with the pullback in commodities, and yet they're instituting some of the kinds of policies that will bear fruit over the medium term. And the reason I mention all those countries is because they're incredibly... they've got very large populations, and things have to go right in big population countries if the rise of the global middle class is going to remain a medium-term theme. And I haven't mentioned China at all. Well, China's going through a major transition. They've built up really quite a considerable excesses, not least from the stimulus that they announced from the in the aftermath of the credit crisis. They're very swiftly transitioning from an investment building and commodity based business model to one that prioritizes the consumer, and to an extent that's something that absolutely has to happen, because otherwise China had to introduce that stimulus because their domestic market was immature. It left their economy very susceptible to shocks elsewhere. The smart thing to do in that kind of environment is to build up your consumer so that you can take more of the weight. You're not totally reliant on what happens elsewhere. Interestingly, that is what India has. That's one of the reasons that India tends to be less volatile in periods of stress. And of course, that's also something that the USA has, where 70% of the economy is the consumer. That also helps to explain why Wall Street has been, despite the fact that it pulled back by 14%, it helps to explain why it didn't pull back by more, at least. And I think, we can say that at least a near-term low has been reached. We won't have confirmation that there's a medium-term low until for quite some time, but certainly so far things are looking really quite favorable. And we know what it would look like if we were to see a further deterioration, because we would see downward dynamics that would really stand out on a daily chart. And in the absence of clear downward dynamics, we can give the benefit of the doubt to, I think, additional higher to lateral ranging would probably be the most realistic prognosis. And because we've had this rotation, now we're seeing the commodity complex starting to rally. Well, the commodity complex was going down because people in China have stopped building. They have enough of copper, and they have enough of steel, they have enough of cement. And these represent markets where there are substantial global surpluses. But it is worth considering that the massive deterioration that we've seen in Latin American and Asian currencies, and Eastern European currencies in particular, that represents a massive enhancement in their competitiveness. And that's the kind of environment where manufacturing really takes off. That's where growth really starts to pick up. So emerging markets in particular, and I absolutely hate that term, but it certainly is a catch-all. And they've been through a really difficult time over the last 3 years, and that may well be ending, not least because their currencies have got at least near-term lows and potentially medium-term lows, considering the extent of the acceleration that we've seen, particularly in the real, the rand, and the rupiah. Well, that would then mean that the potential for growth and for growth to recover from the beginning of next year, and of course it won't show up in statistics for a while after that, that's, I think, increasingly becoming the base case. And generally speaking, that's also good for China. That despite the fact that the focus is now moving towards the consumer and enhancing the value proposition within the manufacturing sector, it's still the workshop of the world. It's still a massive industrial complex, and demand elsewhere is it is certainly in its interests. And the market is not aggressively priced at these levels. And that's particularly the case for places like Hong Kong, where the Hang Seng has single-digit multiples, and the China Enterprises Index, or the H shares, are yielding over 4%. And when one looks around the world, how many markets can you say that have bounced from the lower side of their ranges, have got single-digit multiples, and have got very competitive, globally competitive yields? China stands out. And valuations have improved really quite considerably, despite the fact that we've had just incredible volatility. And of course, that's because we've had incredible volatility. When we look at the fact that the dollar is weakening, then today's move in zinc is because companies like Glencore have little choice but to curtail their supply. Copper today was stronger by 7 cents. It continues to bounce in here. The continuous commodity index is really quite oversold, and this was one of the strongest weeks that we've had in quite some time. Platinum today was stronger by $27. It's back up to 983, having been closer to 900 earlier this week. And what we're seeing is just unwinding of short-term oversold conditions. And mean reversion is now underway. Sugar prices have been trending lower for 5 years. And this is the biggest two-week rally that we've had in at least the last few years. And sugar is now trading back above its 200-day moving average. Well, it's not the first time that it's done that, but it is certainly from a much lower level. And coffee has type 2 bottoming characteristics, but the progression of lower rally highs is still intact. And I think when that eventually goes, then we're in for potentially quite a substantial rally. Where you haven't yet had a great deal of movement is in corn and soybeans, and those are still at comparatively depressed pricing, and particularly when you look at the precious metals or the industrial commodities or even some of the agricultural commodities that are bouncing now. Gold peaked at almost 2000, well, it was 1900 and something dollars nearly 4 years ago, and up 18 in here today to 1157, and that's pretty close to where the 200 day moving average is. And there's been a progression of lower rally highs evident, particularly over the last 2 years, and we're not far from that either. So this is, I think, an under-owned sector, and what you can see is that there are a number of miners that are, well, that have gone through a painful process of rationalization, and they can make money at $1,100. 3 or 4 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case, but it's probably the case now. And gold equities are trading back relative to the gold price where they were in 1999. Gold shares are certainly not expensive at these levels. It remains to be seen whether the catalyst of the weaker dollar in the short term is enough to push gold up enough to break its downtrend. But silver is looking a bit more positive. Silver is up to $15.82 from the high $14 area just 2 weeks ago. And platinum was earlier this week was trading almost $200 below the price of gold. And that's an incredible circumstance. Obviously, the issue with Volkswagen and the diesel engines has not been friendly to platinum, but nonetheless, that was really quite an impressive overextension. Well, there is no corrective phase doesn't produce really attractive opportunities, and I think that there is still time to bottom fish in here, particularly among those that were most overextended and are now bouncing. And generally, when you get a corrective phase like this, it does lead to rotation. A cautionary note, and something that we have mentioned previously, is that a substantial rally in commodities, and that might well now be in the offing. We don't yet have absolute confirmation of that. But a substantial rally in commodities would represent something that you see in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market. And we're quite a long way from when that would give us a topping signal, because it's only just getting started. But and obviously we don't yet have evidence that it is even getting started, but certainly in the short term it looks like commodities are going higher from here, that the dollar has additional room to weaken from here, and that the enhancement that we've had in competitiveness for emerging markets, that really is good for commodities generally. So there's a lot of things falling into place here that could send commodity investments up, and from what are still depressed levels. Well, generally when you get that kind of good news starting to get priced in, that is the kind of environment where interest rates do begin to rise, and that is why it's a late in the cycle phenomenon. So that is something to bear in mind as we address the consistency of various trends and how things look over the next year. And I guess with that, I will leave you for the weekend. I wish all the best to all of you.